Stories are more than the key to imagination. They are a portal to an infinite amount of realms of magic, mystery, and beauty. The magic that lies just under the words of books will carry you out of the realm that you humans have come to know as your only reality. A little do you know, there is so much more to your existence than what is being told to you. Now, follow my voice and find yourself enwrapped in the story, for you will now cross over into another world. It was early in the morning when Catherine Green arrived in San Jose, California. The airport was bustling, with those running late for their flight tripping over themselves, suitcase rolling behind them in one hand as they tried not to spill their coffee in the other. And, of course, there were those who looked like they woke up late, with their hair messy and disheveled while in their pajamas. Catherine may as well have been at the JFK airport. Jacksonville lacked an airport of its own, being such a small and secluded town, so she felt like she was in the big city. Just outside the terminal gates, she followed the arrows and signs that led out of the airport and stood outside with her carry-on, waiting for her Uber driver to pull up. Her phone vibrated. Arrived, the push notification from the Uber app displayed. Her driver pulled up in a simple Toyota Corolla, silver in color. After some dreadfully awkward idle chit-chat, the driver dropped Catherine off at her new home in the Almaden Valley, 213 Trinidad Drive. Kat and her husband, Michael, had lived in Jacksonville, Oregon for pretty much their entire lives. They were high school sweethearts. They brought their first home together, were fur parents to two dogs, both lived to be 15 and 18 respectively, and lived a relatively normal life. She was a writer, nothing big, just worked from home primarily as a columnist for a few papers. Michael was the breadwinner. He was an antiquarian and a researcher for a company called Global Artifacts Association, GAA for short. His job required him to travel quite often, sometimes leaving Catherine for an entire month. Their home was filled to the brim with old dusty books and artifacts from all around the world. In fact, so much so that they had a detached in-laws unit built in their backyard to house most of them. Michael had promised her that they would eventually move out of Jacksonville and travel around the world just after he completed his latest project. Before he passed away, he had located an exceptionally rare artifact, a book titled The Song of Avalos. He stayed up for days straight after that, examining every inch of the artifact. The notes he had compiled filled several notebooks. When Catherine would try to get him to take a break, he would lash out at her. "I'll take a break when I'm done, Kat." This book had him under some sort of spell, it seemed. He had never yelled at her that way before, even when they would get into their spats. One day, she overheard him on the phone talking with who she presumed was his job. "I've never seen anything like it before," he remarked. "It's clearly ancient, and if my calculations are correct, it'd be hundreds of thousands of years old. Yet it's written in English. It's incredible." His excitement, though, was suddenly replaced with reprehension. "What do you mean you want me to destroy my notes on it?" he yelled. "Are you crazy? Why would I... You'll what? I'd like to see you try." And then he furiously threw his phone across the room before pacing feverishly. He did not know she had heard him that day, but she had seen it all play out from outside when she was crossing the backyard to tell him to come inside for lunch. After that, Michael had pretended like everything was fine. He had never mentioned anything about what had happened over the phone that day, and Catherine wasn't going to let him know that she had overheard everything. But a week later, the in-law unit had been broken into. Interestingly, not only was the Song of Avalos book that Michael had been working on missing, but so were his notes and several other artifacts. He was devastated, to say the least. Pulling out her keys, Catherine unlocked the gate into the atrium. Inside were rows of lavender and hyacinth. The smell of flowers hung heavy in the air as she walked along the stone slab path to her front door of her brand new house. Inside the home, it was still, silent, The sound of the birds singing outside could be heard clearly from where she stood. "Motion detected at the front door," the robotic female voice said. It was the alarm system that she had pre-installed. Catherine entered the code and it immediately deactivated. Just in front of her was a staircase that curved to the left and ascended upwards. To the right of her was a dining room, with a glass chandelier hanging elegantly from the ceiling. On her left was a hallway that led into the living room, which had a large brick fireplace. And adjacent to that was the kitchen, with its black granite tiles and stove island. There was a large bay window that overlooked the backyard, which was mostly just freshly cut grass and tan bark with some palm trees and more lavender. For the most part, the movers had done a good job following her directions and placing certain furniture where she had requested they be put. The dining room was already set up and centered with the chandelier. Her chocolate leather couches were in the living room around the television, with her rocking chair next to the fireplace. In the kitchen, she had her pots and pans already hung from the pot rack that they had installed over the kitchen island. Now, she was left to deal with the smaller items, such as her books, clothes, and tabletop decorations. While the morning fog still hung in the autumn sky, Catherine worked for the next few hours slowly unpacking her belongings, organizing them along the way. Fortunately for her, one of the first items she had unpacked was her coffee maker. She filled it with water and coffee grounds and set it to percolate. When it was finished, she poured herself a cup and worked on unpacking another box, one that she had avoided opening earlier. The box was labeled Miscellaneous Decorations, but she knew what contents were really inside. She opened the box and was met with various knickknacks wrapped in old newspapers, but as she emptied it out, the cans of film were revealed under it all. You see, after their in-laws' unit had been broken into back in Jacksonville, Michael had become increasingly paranoid, so much so he purchased a gun behind Catherine's back. The only reason she had found out about it was because she had accidentally stumbled upon it one day while cleaning. When she approached him about it, he was angry and claimed that she was invading his privacy by snooping around where she didn't belong. "You ought to watch yourself, Cat," he had told her with the most sinister of glares. Catherine had taken it as a threat, and immediately tried packing a suitcase to go stay with a friend until he calmed down. The man in front of her was unrecognizable. Michael had never behaved this way with her, let alone threaten her so blatantly like that. But Michael stopped her from leaving, grabbing her arm and pulling her back into the room. "You're hurting me!" Catherine shrieked. But Michael began to shake her by the shoulders. "What is wrong with you, Cat? I got the gun to protect us. We were just broken into and I lost some very valuable artifacts. Don't you know that? It could have been our lives." She did know that, but she also knew that Michael was acting completely out of character, almost like he was scared. Of what? Catherine did not know. "I heard you on the phone the other day." The words had just leapt out of her mouth and into existence. "Did losing that Song of Avalis book make you paranoid, Mike? Is that it?" Michael's eyes widened, and his grip on her loosened. She continued, "Why did whoever you were talking to tell you to destroy your notes on that book? What did you find that whoever you were talking to was so scared about you revealing?" Michael shook his head slowly and held a finger to his lips. Quickly, he made his way to his working table and began scribbling something down on his notepad. He held it up for Catherine to read. "Be quiet. Not here," it read. Catherine opened her mouth to reply, but he stopped her by placing his palm over her lips. He gestured with his hands for them to go into the main house. Once inside, Catherine blurted out, "What on earth is going on here, Mike?" "I know who broke in, Cat," he started. "It was my job. You think a bunch of old men who curate artifacts from around the world broke into our house?" she interrupted. Without so much as a word, Michael made his way to the kitchen drawer, opened it, and pulled out a smoke detector. Inside of it was some type of chip that was wired to where the battery should have been, but was clearly removed. "What am I looking at?" Catherine questioned, a hint of confusion in her voice. "It's a bug, Cat. Whoever they had break in bugged that entire unit. They broke in to take that Song of Avalis book I uncovered. Whoever did it only stole some other unimportant artifacts to make it look like it was a random hit to throw me off. But when I began to find these and a few other of the bugs, my suspicions were confirmed. It was them, Cat." "And this is why you bought the gun?" Yes, he answered. His eyes had a different quality to them. With his furrowed brows and distant stare, Catherine had thought it was a mix of paranoia and anger, but it was really fear she was seeing. What does this mean? She asked, concerned. Who were you talking to that wanted you to destroy your notes on that book? He shook his head. It wasn't just the book, Cat. The book was about a place called Avalis, and a few other artifacts I have refer to this place too. You know that old film canister from the 1930s? The one that seems like it's just random pieces of film spliced together? Catherine knew what film he was referring to. He had shown it to her a while back. In this film, it shows an elaborate dining hall with people dressed in beautiful gowns and sharp suits, eating and drinking without a care in the world. Then, it goes on to show an ornate lobby, almost like a hotel, with an enormous fireplace with people lounging in front of it, bellboys running back and forth up the stairs. Then, after a few other shots, it shows an eerie hallway that leads to a set of large golden doors. In this scene, the camera pans to the walls and shows a large painting of a map with the name Avalis written next to it. That was when the film ended. Well, Michael continued, that film showed that one painting, remember? The map that was called Avalis. So I did some more digging to find out what this place was. I mean, the map doesn't match with any known place in the world, but it was clearly important enough to be filmed, painted, and hung up, right? I looked through my archives, manuscripts, and records and found something interesting. There is a small place in San Jose, California called Almaden Valley, and overlooking this valley was a place called the Blue Horn Tower. That was where that film was taken. But that's not the strange part. I looked up this Blue Horn Tower, and I cannot find a single shred of information about it online. But this manuscript talks about it with great detail, stating that people had gone missing there and it was bringing a lot of negative attention to the Blue Horn family, so they sold the property to the government, who tore the manor down and replaced it with a radio tower. Now, listen to this. No one in Almaden remembers the Blue Horn Tower ever existing. No one in the entire country does, actually. It's like it was erased from everyone's memory somehow. And that radio tower still sits atop of that same mountain, watching over that same valley. Michael, you're freaking me out. What does this have to do with anything? I think I uncovered something I wasn't supposed to, Kat. That Song of Avalis book predated anything I've ever seen. It was impossibly ancient, almost like it came from a different universe or something. And it spoke of this Avalis place as if it were real. Michael had filled her in on the remainder of the details he had uncovered. His fear and paranoia made complete sense to Catherine after that. In fact, now in fear herself, she applauded him on purchasing the gun when he did. But that gun did them no good, because just 3 weeks later, she had returned home from a routine doctor's appointment, the one time she had left the house in months, and found Michael slumped over at his work table in the in-laws unit. When she approached him, though, he wouldn't respond. She shook him and began to scream, begging him to get up, but he would never leave that table on his own. The paramedics came quickly after she had frantically called 911, and they were the ones who had wheeled his lifeless body out of there. When Catherine had met with the coroner, he had told her that Michael had passed away from a sudden heart attack that must have been brought on by stress and anxiety. But when they were alone, the coroner changed his story. Much to Catherine's surprise, the man entrusted some clandestine information to her. "Ms. Green," he started, "may I ask you a question, just between us? Did your husband have any enemies, perhaps someone high up with a lot of power?" Catherine's heart palpitated. Michael's revelations had come flooding into her mind at that moment. His discoveries, that forsaken Avalis book, the film, the Blue Horn Tower, all of it. "No, not that I know of," she lied. "Why do you ask?" "Well," the old man removed his glasses and polished the lenses of the rag he had procured from his jacket pocket. "I received a visit from the most unusual man. Didn't give me his name, but he advised that your husband had died from a heart attack. Now, I found this most peculiar, considering I had just performed the autopsy and found no such evidence." "What are you saying, Mr. Blackwood?" "I'm saying that your husband did not die from a heart attack. At least, not from what I could tell. I did find trace amounts of barbiturates in his system and evidence that he had been suffocated somehow. If I had a guess, it seems that he had fallen asleep from these drugs, and someone had done the deed of sneaking up on him and somehow cutting off his oxygen. It was clean, precise. Like I said, I don't know who that man was, but he was insistent that I lied to you, going as far as threatening my livelihood if I did not comply. Why are you telling me all this then? What if you lose your job? Catherine was jarred, yet she wasn't surprised. From the moment she found Mike, she knew that there was something off about the whole thing. In fact, her initial screams when she discovered his body weren't because she was in disbelief. Rather, she was frightened that Mike's employer had gone to this length to silence him. It was then that she realized Michael had stumbled into something much bigger than he had initially thought. I'm telling you this, Miss Green, because you seem like a kind woman, and I do not want you leaving here today with a false sense of security that your husband died from natural causes. You have the right to know the truth, and since I don't take kindly to threats, I was obliged to give it to you. I believe you are owed that much, with your husband gone at such a young age. A week later, Catherine had heard that Mr. Blackwood had been in a fatal car accident. It went without saying that she knew there was more to it than a mere accident. Keeping his secret, Catherine never revealed what Mr. Blackwood had confided in her to anyone, not even Mike's parents. She knew the moment she opened her mouth, she would be next. The Global Artifacts Association came to her house and removed all of her husband's artifacts from her home, offering their deepest apologies for Mike's sudden passing. But they hadn't taken everything, for she had kept the rolls of film and camera equipment hidden under the floorboards in the main house. Carefully, Catherine walked to her bay window in the kitchen and sipped on her coffee. The infamous Mount Ominum was clearly visible from where she stood, and sitting atop it was the radio tower that had replaced the mysterious Blue Horn Tower Hotel. She hadn't come to Alma Den out of dumb luck. No, she came with a mission in mind, to uncover the secrets that her husband was so close to revealing, to continue the work that Mike had died for. Finishing her coffee, Catherine picked up the camera equipment and brought it down into the basement. The room was illuminated with a single light bulb that hung from the ceiling, revealing the dark, cool concrete flooring and walls, as well as the various boxes that the movers had placed down there. Attentively, Catherine removed the roll of film from the canister that Mike had labeled BHT for Blue Horn Tower and set it into the camera. She then took some time to assemble the tripod and the projector. When she was finally done, Mike's words echoed in her mind. Just before he was killed, he had shown her some of what he had uncovered. According to him, there were some artifacts that were more unique than others because they possessed an otherworldly quality. With one of the other rolls of film, he showed her cloaked figures using books as portals to another realm, disappearing into them as if they were some type of door that had sucked them in. When he zoomed in on the books they were using, it was the Song of Avalos. Before their home had been broken into, he explained to her that he discovered some kind of dead language that these people used to activate the power of these ancient artifacts. But he was unable to try it himself, for he was missing an important component. A sacrifice. The power that linked these artifacts to these other worlds was dark, unknown, and ancient. The BHT film roll was one of those artifacts that possessed this power, this magic, or whatever it was. But, unlike the others, it did not require a sacrifice to be awakened. According to Mike, he was able to open some sort of interdimensional door with another roll of film when he uttered the words of that dead tongue. Of course, he did not dare enter whatever it was he had awakened out of fear that he would be unable to return. However, when he had attempted the same with the BHT film, it didn't work. This led him to conclude that in order for this particular artifact to open its door, if you will, it had to be in the Almaden Valley. He never got the chance to test this hypothesis, but here she was, the test dummy to his conjectures. But Catherine wouldn't be uttering those words to open the door into the past. Not now, anyway. First, she needed to mentally prepare herself for whatever it was she was about to awaken. For all she knew, when she passed that threshold, that thin veil that separates the fabric of time and space from other worlds, she would be unable to return. After locking up, Catherine left her home and walked north up Trinidad Drive, turning west onto Crown Boulevard. The wind was unsettling, with it whistling through the trees and whipping up the dead leaves that had found their final resting place on the floor. The clouds overhead were menacing, foreboding, and in front of her, looming in the distance, was Mount Ominum, watching every step she was taking. She couldn't help but feel that this radio tower was alive somehow, that it knew what she was planning on doing. In that moment, she tried placing herself into the shoes of those that lived back when the Bluehorn Tower had been up there on that mountain, wondering if they too felt like the infamous manor was watching them. A voice came from behind her. "I thought I was the only crazy one who went out for a jog during this time of year." It was a young woman, pretty with a kind face. She was clearly younger than Catherine, probably in her 30s. "Mind if I walk with you?" Catherine didn't mind, but she did not want to be rude. "Sure, that's fine." The woman removed her earphones and said, "Name's Brooke." "Catherine," she gestured to herself. "Nice to meet you." Brooke looked Catherine up and down quickly. "I take it you're not jogging, unless the new thing out here is running in your jeans and a cardigan," she laughed. "No, no, not jogging. Just clearing my mind with a quick walk. Did you just move here?" "Yeah, technically. But I grew up here, then left for the East Coast to go to college. I just got back because my mother passed away. How about you? How long have you lived here?" Catherine was taken back. How peculiar that they would both be in Almaden for similar reasons. "I'm sorry to hear that," she said. "I just moved here, actually. I'm from Oregon, but my husband passed away unexpectedly and I needed a change of scenery. So, here I am." During their conversation, Catherine noticed that Brooke kept looking over her shoulder as if she were troubled. When she would return her gaze to Kat, though, she would smile and carry on as if nothing was wrong. But, after walking for a few more minutes, Brooke leaned in, her voice a mere whisper, and asked, "Is there someone following us?" Caught off guard, Catherine slowly turned her head over her shoulder and saw nothing. There hadn't even been a single car on the road, so Catherine was confused as to why Brooke would ask her such a question. "No? Did you see someone?" she asked. Brooke raised her brow and nervously chewed on her lower lip.
I thought I did. To be honest, that was why I stopped to talk with you. There was this man. He kept following me whichever street I turned down. It freaked me out, so when I saw you, I ran over here."
Perhaps the feeling of being watched wasn't coming from the radio tower after all.
"I'm glad you stopped then. Here, take my number and we can walk together from now on. We're stronger in groups."
"That's so sweet of you," Brooke gushed. After taking down Kat's number, Brooke said, "We are close to my house now, so I'll just make a break for it for the rest of the way. Thank you for letting me walk with you, and it was nice meeting you. Be safe."
And with that, Brooke picked up her jog once again, disappearing down a quiet residential street. Now, Catherine felt like running herself, but she maintained her brisk walk back to her house and returned to her basement. There, the camera waited to be turned on. Her mind was racing. Part of her was screaming to not do what she was about to do, that it would be a mistake she would come to regret. But the other side of her encouraged her, ushering her to hurry and speak the words of the dead tongue into existence to see what happened. With a flip of a switch, the camera turned on, and the film started. On the concrete wall in front of her played the same film she had seen before, depicting the main lobby of the Bluehorn Tower. Apprehensively, Catherine picked up the few pages of Mike's notes that she had saved and began to read the words. "Ador dinar," she started. Just then, the light bulb began to violently flicker. "Slav akbor, den shak lamur." The film's footage began to become distorted, with various lines and static that had not been there before sweeping over the images. "Farak mavor de behoth, abisak marok den." Suddenly, the light bulb burnt out, casting the room in darkness. The film stopped, and it was replaced with a field of stars like she was peering into space itself. Then, slowly, something was coming toward her from the distance. It was a door, and on it was a symbol of the all-seeing eye. Catherine moved from behind the camera and toward the door that was now directly in front of her, appearing like it was really on her wall. Her mouth was dry, her breathing was erratic. With each step she took, she expected the door to open up and swallow her whole. But all that happened was the eye seemed to follow her movement, carefully watching. There was a sound coming from behind the door now. It was music, some sort of jazz. But it sounded distorted, like it was being played underwater or through a storm. Catherine reached for the doorknob, staring right back at the eye that was studying her intently. With one fell pull of the door, Catherine whipped it open, half expecting to find someone waiting on the other side. But there was no one. All that lay behind it was a dark, cavernous tunnel of stars that led into an abyss. The sound of the jazz music became clearer as it echoed into the tunnel from somewhere afar, perversely distorted. With a deep breath, Catherine closed the door behind her ever so carefully and entered the tunnel. All around her, the stars twinkled and shot across the velvety black fabric of space. In front of her, the black void slowly began to churn, revealing a faint purple light. The closer Catherine got, the bigger this blossoming portal became, until she was eventually enwrapped in it, surrounded by nothing but bright light for the briefest of moments. Then, she was somewhere else, somewhere unfamiliar. Lying ahead of her was a dark, cavernous tunnel that was sparingly lit by torches along the walls, making the rocky material appear like hammered gold. The further she went into this tunnel, she noticed there were far more paths that appeared to connect with her own. Freezing in her tracks, as if her feet had been suddenly rooted into the ground, she listened. There was something fast approaching. A noise. Someone, or something, was coming. Oh, the things we do for love. It seems that our friend, Catherine Green, may be a little in over her head. Subscribe and hit the bell below to hear more stories that we have curated for you. See you next time.